Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will be continuing our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. We live today in the age of the copy. Many of us consume culture through the medium of copies, downloading MP3s or movies, making copies, sending on copies. Our sense of ourselves as bodies, as replicating DNA machines, makes us very aware of the copying that goes on in the human body and in human reproduction in particular. All the furor over stem cells is, in a sense, a kind of nervousness about what is legitimate and illegitimate copying of genetic material. And at the same time, our society is swimming with copies, with mass industrial products, and increasingly ordinary people are getting their hands on replicators. We're just starting to see the emergence of inexpensive home replicators that allow people to, say, design three-dimensional objects and have them reproduced right there in the home. And if you just cycle that process forward a few years, let alone decades, and you are starting to see the possibility of almost anyone being able to replicate almost anything. So in many ways, the copy is one of the great signs and symbols of our age, but we don't think about it very well, or at least that's part of the argument of our guest today, Marcus Boone, who wrote an absolutely fabulous book called In Praise of Copying that I really urge everyone to read, regardless of whether they're interested in intellectual property or spirituality or cultural reproduction or where we are now. It's a really wonderful, broad, but also very penetrating book about copying, taking it from the political and cultural level, ultimately to the metaphysical one. But before I bring Marcus on, I'd like to introduce our co-host, Maja Daou, the White Witch of Los Angeles. And Maja, in L.A., in some ways, L.A. is kind of the mecca of copying, isn't it?
It really is, Eric. I mean, you can't walk down the street without seeing, like, Louis Vuitton knockoffs everywhere you go. And people grasp onto an image of something, and then it gets reiterated throughout the culture of Los Angeles. It just gets copied from the streets of Beverly Hills right on down to, like, the ghettos, right? You see copies of that image that somehow got, like, a prototype and then just expanded throughout the entire culture of Los Angeles. It's kind of unbelievable how fast it works, too. And then, like, that L.A. fashion, for example, then, like, infiltrates the nation. I mean, L.A. kind of starts here, and then everyone looks at the gossip columns and then copies the way that all the celebrities are looking. It's really amazing. But the thing that I like the best about this concept of copying is that, you know, we're all copying every second of every day. It's in our flesh and blood. Like, that's what our DNA does every second. Like, it's copying and replicating. And I think that we forget that we totally are made up of copiers. Like, that's exactly what our entire anatomy is doing on a constant, you know, basis.
Absolutely. Well, that's sort of we're already getting into the conversation. So I'd like to bring on Marcus Boone. Marcus, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric and Marcia. Great to be here.
Yeah, I want to say that I've had the great good fortune of knowing Marcus for many, many years, and I was also impressed also by his first book, Roads of Excess, which is about the relationship of drugs and literature. But for this book, you went in a very different direction. Tell me, what was going on in your life or your mind that led you to undertake this, what clearly was a many years process of diving into the copy?
Well, actually, I'm not sure the drug stuff is actually that far away from the copying stuff, because I mean, one way of thinking about drug cultures or drug experiences is in terms of a culture of the copy. You know, some of the main objections people have to drug experiences are that they're artificial, that they produce a kind of replica of an experience that is a kind of fake version of an otherwise authentic, natural experience of subjectivity that one should somehow be able to have. So, you know, the drugs themselves are replicated, they're multiples, they're duplicates, and they double our own consciousness. They produce a double of consciousness. And I think that's quite disturbing for a lot of people. And it was something that interested me in terms of writing, because not only do you have drug experiences themselves as these kind of weird doubles of consensus reality, let's say, that shouldn't really be there and yet are there in some sense, sort of perturbing and disturbing our sense of what materiality is. But then you have the act of writing about these experiences, which creates another copy, and a kind of unstable copy that, you know, it also has many questions about how true or false it is, whether it leads people into illusion or into revelation. So a lot of it, issues that actually come out in relationship to copies and the ethics of copying, I think we're already there in terms of drug experience, actually.
Well, let's follow up this idea of the disturbing quality of copying, because I think that, as even from what Maja was saying, and clearly from what you talk about in your book, again, whether you look at things technologically, culturally, biologically, even metaphysically, that the closer you look, the more copies and more copying you see. And yet there's something in us, and certainly something in society at large, that has a horror of that. It's very disturbing. It's chaotic. It's questioning. Talk a little bit about, I mean, I know that's one of the things that you do in your book, is to really address, well, why is it, do we have the, what are the ideas we have that prevent us from seeing and accepting and even celebrating or praising copying as we find it, you know, throughout our reality?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's the whole issue of individualism and the ideology of individualism as it appears today in kind of global capitalist society, where we're all kind of told that our authenticity is linked to an idea of our uniqueness and our individuality and the choices we make, and our ability to express ourselves in terms of those choices. And most of those choices happen within a kind of consumer culture, which means that they're choices that are happening where we're looking for a reflection of ourselves, in other words, a copy of ourselves, in consumer culture. And so there's a doubling that's happening there, right? And, you know, we're the inheritors of a very long kind of Western philosophical and political tradition, out of which the ideas of individuality, which we have today, have emerged. And there's very kind of powerful and often good reasons why individuality emerged in the way that we have it today. And some of our ideas of freedom are connected to those ideas. So there's good and bad aspects to that. But when you really look at it, that notion of individuality that we have is a copy. It's not actually ourselves. Even the names that we have as individuals that we identify with are not really ours. And as such, one might kind of want to look into that, to what's going on there, as to why we think that our individuality can truly exist through what ultimately is a copy. And for me, I guess, I've been studying Buddhism and kind of related discipline for a decade or two now, and I think I, at a certain point, my interest in Buddhism and the kind of questioning of what our essence, what our individuality consists of in Buddhism, kind of merged with my interest in consumer culture and the critique of consumer culture. And I could see that although Buddhism doesn't explicitly address issues of copying or imitation that much, in fact, there's a very profound analysis of copying in Buddhism, and the way that we try to hold on to things as they appear, to those kind of doubles, whether they're doubles of language, doubles of materiality, doubles of subjectivity. We try to hold on to those things when, in fact, they don't really exist in the way that we think they do. And as a meditator, one can experience that. And as a philosopher, one can analyze it and also come to that conclusion.
Well, that's one of the wonderful things about your book is it's a really fresh expression of how Buddhist ideas can help us grapple with, you know, real issues of our own lives and our own experience, but also ways of thinking about what's happening in culture, what's happening with the future of the world, with how we think about the world, in a way that doesn't fit in the metaphysics section or the self-help spirituality section. It really enters into brings Buddhism really to the heart of a lot of these contemporary questions. But it also makes me think about and I'm sure you have many similar experiences. Near Ukiah in California, there's the city of 10,000 Buddhas, and if you go into the great hall of the city of 10,000 Buddhas, which is actually in a former insane asylum, and they have this huge gym, and then they transformed it into a temple. And you go in, and the walls of this enormous space are lined with identical Buddha statues. Thousands, maybe 10,000, thousands of these Buddha statues, and it's an overwhelming experience of copying, but in a temple, in a religious context, in a sacred context. But it reminds you of an Andy Warhol print, you know, a metaphysical Andy Warhol print. Is there something specific about that? The imaginative element of Buddhism, or the space that's opened up, that can give you a flavor of the way they approach this issue of copying, something about the why such an image would work in a Buddhist context of all of these replicating copies.
Yeah, well, I think in Buddhism, okay, there's an analysis of essence, or let's say of appearance, that shows that there's no essence to any phenomena, anything that appears to us. But appearance is still there as a kind of flickering, impermanent, kind of omnipresent thing that we have to deal with. And like a crude analysis of it would be to just say, those appearances are illusions. They have no actual reality. They're merely kind of flickering, impermanent moments. But I think a more profound analysis of that quality of appearance is that we're always in this situation of dealing with copies, repetitions, and if we accept those repetitions, those flickering copies as a reality, then we're in what's called samsara. We're in the grip of illusion. If we let go of that a little bit, then what opens up is this kind of vast multiplicity, this vast cloud of appearances that neither exists nor doesn't exist. And from a certain point of view, the Buddhist idea, like of these multiple, the 10,000 Buddhas, that everything that does appear has at its core Buddha nature, which would be essencelessness. So you have this funny thing that every phenomenal appearance actually manifests essencelessness.
Well, and it's true, and that's the tricky part, is that it's through the repetition that you can get to that, like, singularity and non-existence of the essencelessness, right? It's through, because like you said, like, it's part of reality that we have these copies, and like all those Buddhas sitting there are representing that is the reality, but it's only through, like in Buddhism, how you repeat a mantra over and over again, and that's how you get to the source of it, and how you get to the origin of it is only through, like, repeating and copying it over and over, and then you, like, get to that point of singularity. So that's kind of interesting that it's through those repetitions and dualities that you get to the singularity, kind of because they are part of our reality or samsara, and that you have to kind of go through that to get there.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's taking charge of the universal machinery of repetition and actually trying to explore it that Buddhism teaches you, and it teaches you that through a series of practices.
Right.
And there's the repetition of the mantra, there's visualization, which is very much about, you know, creating a copy in your head, and that copy is a copy of ultimate reality, and you work with it imaginatively, but you also work with it in your daily life, where you try to bring the copy, the ultimate reality, out in the phenomena that you're dealing with in your everyday life. And, I mean, I would say yoga, various yoga practices are also very much practices of copying, where you adjust posture, you adjust your attitude, you adjust your mind to kind of imitate perfection. And in one way, it's still within the realm of samsara and a certain belief in essence, but you push it in the direction through repetition of something else coming up. And that something doesn't have an essence, and yet it's there in all phenomena anyway, it's just that we don't see it.
Right.
This is a wonderful stuff, but I wanted to also take it in another direction and talk a little bit about intellectual property. You know, when people address the issue of copying today in a cultural or political or even technological context, it's usually around this issue of the fact that the digital regime allows us to make, in some sense, infinite copies of things without degradation, and therefore this threatens a whole set of industries based on controlling copies and access to copies through various means. And this means that a lot of the politics of copying today are around issues of intellectual property and technological reproduction. And you address these as well, but you also kind of make a point about how we sort of miss something a little bit when we think too much about intellectual property as the issue to deal with when we think about the culture of copying.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in a way, we're obsessed with the 1% of our experience where we consciously label things as being copies, and we want to argue and fight about that 1%, you know, the MP3s, the books, the Louis Vuitton bags. And we think that if we can come up with an agreement or an organization or arrangement of copying within that 1% of our total experience, that the matter is dealt with and you know, the case is closed. But for me, I'm really interested in that 99% of our experience and our activity and our being in the world where we don't think of it as copying. And yet, when you look in and dig around a little bit, you'll see the same structures of copying, repetition, imitation, informing that other part of our experience. And I think in some ways, we've set things up so that we have a kind of scapegoat for the problem of imitation, of copying, in this little struggle about intellectual property, that helps us kind of not think about the broader context that's in a way much more perturbing, but also much more liberating potentially if we can address it and understand it. It's just that it's quite challenging to do so. And I think a lot of us still have our hopes invested in that idea that it's if we only stick to the 1% of consumer culture, that everything will be solved in that arena.
Well, I think it's true, and I think part of that is people ignore the sources of things. Like, they'll see that someone has this brilliant idea, and they think that that exists in some kind of vacuum, that 1% becomes a vacuum disconnected from everything else. And they forget that every idea coming out of that 1% is connected to these sources and origins that informed the people's lives that came up with the ideas, like their entire histories, their parents, their cultures they grew up in. Like, all of this stuff went into those ideas in that 1%, but that we, like, fracture it and cut it out and put it into this, like, little thing that's disconnected from everything else. And that, I think, leads a lot to that, like, isolation of the 1% that prevents it from kind of, like, going back to the source of it.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's all about interdependence, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you take the Buddhist idea of interdependence seriously, that everything in the universe is constituted by, like, an infinite series of relationships, a chain of relationships in which a particular object or being appears.
Right.
That's also true in terms of intellectual property. And instead of facing that and building a society that is able to face that with its laws and all the rest of it, we've kind of fetishized, like, the moment of grasping onto ourselves, of our work, the particular thoughts that come into our head, and we want to forget everything that sort of went into us coming up with the original thought, the original expression that supposedly is ours. Mm. And I think it's a delicate matter when I speak about it that way. I think it's, we really are attached to those things, and to, I'm not really arguing in favor of prying away or grasping an attachment immediately, because I think the trauma of that would be too much for most of us, including me. But I think we can let go a little bit and learn to let go a little bit, and in terms of intellectual property law, what that would mean is the opening up of the public domain and fair use as spaces and doctrines where we're able to share things and have things in common.
Well, that's one of the things I think about that brings us into that greater embrace of the copying that we do and the copying that in some sense we are, is the celebratory and playful aspects of it. And that's something you bring through very much in your book. In fact, some of the strongest chapters for me really had to do with this idea of copying as abundance. And it's a way of understanding a lot of what's driving the politics of you know, the Creative Commons and the attempts to open up the processes of cultural reproduction to more and more players. But it's not just about politics or even culture. It's really about a certain way of affirming copying. And I think one of the really important things to emphasize is that I think sometimes, and you do this well in your book, is that when people think copying, they think absolute perfect copy. But of course, A, no such thing exists, and B, therefore, what copying is really more as much about variation as it is about strict repetition. And that when you start to see it that way, then the copying that you do, playing a song that you learned from a record, which was the song itself was borrowed from some other musician, and et cetera, like we find ourselves in these chains of variations. But there can be incredibly creative, and you have some wonderful examples, hip-hop, folk music, of how a lot of the cultures that we enjoy in the world today embrace this process of variation and repetition in a way that doesn't make the same mistakes as the cultural authenticity and originality that you're talking about. But so talk about some of those subcultures and the ones that really inspire you to this vision of copying.
Well, I mean, you use the word subculture, and in the book I talk a lot about what I call folk cultures. And when we say subculture, like, we usually mean some contemporary culture usually of somewhat dispossessed or subaltern people who exist on the margin of society and then kind of appropriate and steal different things and make a culture, like a subculture out of it. And the implication is really there that the subcultures are parasitical on industrial consumer culture, which is the real thing. And I kind of wanted to think about it the other way around, because it's pretty clear the human cultures in general are very good at developing these modes of sharing, of producing collaboratively. And the history of music, the history of folk song, the history of art, the history of festivals, of celebration, of cooking, of quilts. Like, there's an endless list of examples you can come up with of what I would call folk cultural copying. And I wanted to affirm that that's kind of like our natural condition almost, like to make and share copies. We exist in a very intimate relationship to the reality of our situation, of our potential as imitating beings when we participate in folk cultures. And that aspect of being human was kind of repackaged in the Industrial Revolution and then sold back to people in the form of consumer culture. But I think it's the industrial practice of copying, which is built around copying. Industrial machinery spits out, you know, infinite mass copies of things.
Well, it's very interesting, because that does exactly mirror nature. And what you're talking about, industrial copies kind of eliminate the variation, like Eric was talking about, right? Because it's all, like, exactly the same. But folk culture is more like natural selection almost, where you get, like, literally when you get sexual reproduction, there's two different people or two different cultures that come together in a folk style, and then they make something which is the same, but it's both of them together, and so it's a little bit different. So you get a little bit of variation in the reproduction, because it's coming through like a couple of different sources that are then coming together, so it's slightly different. But then with industrialization, you get just like exact replicas, so there's not as much variation. So it's almost like genetically weaker because it doesn't have that kind of extra added oomph of being able to have more to draw from, you know, from the inside out, because it's all limited in its kind of structure of reproduction.
And you can see the ways that the law has been kind of set up to facilitate that kind of production, and the way that it seems to protect an essence to the object that's always identical. And you know, you can understand the pathos of the situation too, that if you're, for example, buying a drug, like, you don't want there to be too much variation in the molecule. Like, you the advantages of that kind of rigorous scientific measurement of the effects of particular substances, like, it's important in medicine, and that's a kind of valuable moment where a repetition that's almost identical is very useful. But on the other hand, I think I love Marcel Duchamp for pointing out that in actual fact there really are no identical copies ever.
Right.
You know, when he put this urinal on a pedestal in, I don't know, 1916 at an art show and called it Fountain, and it was just a urinal he bought used somewhere, but it was an industrial product, and he presented it as a unique object.
Mm-hmm.
When you really look at it, no two objects can occupy time and space simultaneously. They have different atoms, different molecules, they have different histories. It actually makes you think about industrial production in a different way, to think about the individuality of supposedly mass-produced multiple items.
Well, there's a whole wonderful culture that if you're an LP collector, one is, you know, everyone will have copies that they picked up, some used copy, but they're marked in some original way, like somebody wrote their name on it. I have this like one copy of Dylan's Planet Waves that has this long like love letter on the back of it and like a ballpoint pen. And then there's the way that the individual copies themselves begin to degrade, and you hear sort of sounds of history enter into it. And of course, I am talking about an analog medium, but I still think it applies to lots of things. And then there's even the ways that, you know, if you get into the collector market, they know that there's different, you know, pressings of the same album actually have these minute differences that you can tell. So there's a desire to sort of incorporate these supposedly perfect copies into a world of unique variation, I guess you could call it that. That it, a world, like I think you say, that we're much more comfortable with.
Well, you know, I think Walter Benjamin's idea of the aura is kind of useful thinking about this. And Benjamin, for the most part, presented it in terms of art objects and kind of what he thought of as unique pre-industrial objects that had particular histories, and that the aura of an object was its kind of historical uniqueness, that when you looked at such and such a painting or a sculpture, you were looking at the whole of its history, which you experienced in the form of an aura. And he said that he saw mechanical reproduction and industrialization were the death of the aura, because things no longer had a history. You know, they were just spat out as identical objects. But I think we've kind of proven Walter Benjamin wrong, and in actual fact, and like you just said, Eric, everything seems to have an aura, even these sort of multiple LPs, like everyone is slightly different, and in fact they do all have histories, and those histories are quite beautiful, and being attuned to the way in which history marks and transforms objects, it's a beautiful aspect of copying. You know, that's in a way where the story, our story is in those acts of marking by which things take the particular form they do.
Well, this is a wonderful conversation. We've got to take a break right now. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. We're talking with Marcus Boone on Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back after this.
PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Adam Kolker from the Brooklyn Jazz Underground. We're going to be hosting a weekly show every Tuesday at 5 p.m., focusing on sounds coming from the borough of Brooklyn. We'll be playing some new releases, doing live interviews, some live performances, maybe even venture out into music from some of the outer boroughs. Brooklyn Jazz Underground, Tuesday at 5, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Town.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent news.
Copy anything. Everything is supposed to be totally unique and your own, and nothing can be plagiarized. But Marcus brings up a lot of really interesting points in his book, and I wanted to ask you, Marcus, there's this idea, I'm very into like that idea of evolution and where it comes from, and I really liked the 100th monkey concept where, you know, basically monkey washes his potato. And these other monkeys watch him wash his potato, and then they all start to copy him. And then an amount of monkeys copy what they saw, right, spontaneously. So the story goes, it infects the consciousness of monkeys over the place. And I was wondering if you had thoughts on, like, how through copying we can lead to, like, consciousness shifts, and how copying can actually, like, kind of trigger an evolutionary change, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, I find that story an interesting one. I'm not entirely sure I buy the story, mm-hmm. but it's quite similar to a lot of the stuff Malcolm Gladwell talks about in The Tipping Point, and I think there's a lot of interest right now in general in ideas of the contagion of ideas. Like, how it is things spread or disseminated. And in my work, you know, I was a student of Michael Taussig, the anthropologist, and the way he taught my Mises was that there were things that looked the same as each other and then things that touch each other. And the touching was also a form of imitation, that somehow something was transmitted from one being or object to another through touch. And the voodoo doll, for example. You know, with a voodoo doll, you have an image or an effigy of some other person, but you also include, like, a bit of pubic hair or a fragment of skin or something like that in the voodoo doll. And it's the kind of presence of that matter that sort of contagiously allows you, at least mythically, to have control over someone through that image, through that doll. So I felt like that was really interesting, and there's all kinds of situations in which that contagion of touch operates, like shaking hands or toasting when we knock wine glasses or beer mugs together, where we establish some kind of connectivity through touch. But it wasn't clear to me exactly, like, what the basis of that really is. Like, why does it work insofar as it works?
Well, scientifically, I mean, you do actually exchange electrons with everything you touch. I mean, they call it, like, van der Waals forces, right? And literally every time you come into contact with something, there's an exchange of electrons that are passed from the one thing touching to the other thing. So it's actually physically true that you do have an exchange.
Yeah. One of the examples in your book that I think is really great, that really captures this magic and how it's still operative in our culture today, is your analysis. I mean, you have a long, extended analysis of the Louis Vuitton bag, but there's one where you talk about how in the advertisements, you see these celebrities, and they're often looking very classy, but also very happening, very alive. And it's not just that they're shown with the bag, but they're shown clutching the bag. They're holding the bag. And so that then you as a consumer go in, it's not just that you want the bag as a symbol of whatever you think it might be, but that you too can clutch the bag and in so doing get a little bit of that magic from the celebrity.
Yeah, no, there's some kind of, like, I'd call it tactile magic there, and the image, you know, that's the thing, is you, it's not like when you look at Uma Thurman holding one of those bags and then you buy the bag, it's not even that, you know, you're a bag that Uma Thurman touched, you're really touching something, the image of which was touched by Uma Thurman in it. And something is still transmitted there, which is very interesting, I think. And that's the kind of level of contagiousness I think we have to think. It's almost, it's like a mental contagion, a contagion of ideas that somehow is everything we do, I would say.
Well, how do you square these ideas with some of the things that come out of like the tipping from like a marketing perspective? Like if you're sitting there and you're a marketer, you want nothing more than to sort of think of consumers as kind of replicators. So out there and replicate your meme, your product, your ideology. You know, there's a way in which there's kind of an there's a apparatus around copying as well. How do you reconcile the sort of more, at least potentially liberatory vision you have of copying with the way in which, with ideology or consumerism or in other ways, that copying and replication are used to, you know, further drive consumption and mindless reproduction and all of that?
Yeah, well, clearly we're living in a world in which a particular regime of copying is functioning, and the fact that marketers, advertising is so important today in our world is an indication of the power of imitation, the power of copying. But the question is, what is the source of that power, and are there other ways of using that power? Because it's quite clear that people that administrate nations and states, they understand the power of copying. And, you know, we exist as imitating beings. We could get all structuralist about it and talk about people like Althusser, who pointed out the way in which the structures we inhabit demand of us to perform or act in certain ways, that we imitate certain forms of behavior, and that then becomes the basis of the organization of society. But, you know, I think there's a fundamental drive to copy, to make copies. It's part of being human. It's part of how the universe in general manifests and exists. And there are particular ways of organizing that. And different societies organize it in different ways. And you could look at medieval Tibetan Buddhist society on the one hand, maybe a big native culture around 1700 as another example. You could look at the society we inhabit now as being a different organization of copying. And there's definitely dark purposes, dark ways of framing that. It's not just about capitalism. When you think about Gnosticism, that's an example of framing of what the universe is. It's very dark and built around the idea that this existence is a kind of bad copy. And Philip K. Dick and people like that took that up in particular ways. I like the work of René Girard, who's a Christian philosopher who made imitation the center of his work. And he has a very dark reading of imitation, that, you know, imitation basically causes nothing but trouble, and that somehow Christ actually destroys the logic of imitation through sacrificing himself and somehow frees everyone from the trap of imitation. And he kind of backed away from that particularly dark reading of things in his later work, where he talks about practice repetition within Christianity. But yeah, there's no question that there's many negative uses copying put to. But
well, I mean, when you take like the idea, you had mentioned that it's like a contagion, right? An infiltration. That's the implications of copying, right? Is that it can take on a viral level, and that's literally like a virus is the gnarliest example in nature. A copier, right? That's all it does is replicate itself, and it does it so much so that it like destroys everything else. So to me, kind of like years of copying, that some of the things that you'd brought up is when it takes on like those viral proportions, when it obliterates history and origin and everything else, and all it is all these copies, and it destroys any of the pre-existing structures that were there.
Well, I think we have to love our virus too, and a meaningful concept of compassion includes compassion for our viruses. And and I remember when I was involved in AIDS research, that talking to an AIDS researcher and who was explaining how HIV worked, and he pointed out that basically AIDS, like a lot of viruses, just kind of floats around, and it has like its own being. You can't really just call it a replicator. It actually has it is an entity of a kind, and it's only in certain circumstances that the kind of pathological potential of the virus is really activated. And even then, you know, that the body has ways of kind of balancing the cycles of replication, and it has its own, it replicates antibodies that, you know, respond to the copies of the virus. So you have this kind of detente of copies of the virus and copies of the immune system's various modulators that are swimming around in the body. And, you know, viruses, I think, are really important in evolution too, that probably a lot of evolutionary change actually is the result of viral interference, and it's really important in that sense that it's one of the ways in which the disruption of the identical copy happens. But I think it would happen anyway. Like, there cannot be a simply identical replica, really.
Marcus, I want to ask you a little bit, maybe on a slightly more personal tip. At the end of the book, you talk about the balance between appropriation and disappropriation. You know, appropriation being we're always trying to grab a hold of something that will, you know, make us feel like we're in essence, that we're going to exist, that we're going to continue to exist, something that fills us up, something to collect, something to hold on to. And that this is a, you know, widespread strategy of just, you know, keeping on, and that while it has its place, you talk about, and particularly in a sort of Buddhist context, about disappropriation, letting be or letting go. I'm just curious how your thoughts and your reading and your studying of this issue has influenced you, you know, more personally in terms of how you approach spiritual practice, how you approach Buddhism, and how these ideas have illuminated ways of being in the world for you.
Yeah, I find it the most challenging thing, because when you talk about deappropriation and the giving up of the urge to appropriate, it sounds kind of scary and, again, sort of dark in a way. And then what? You're going to be unable to protect yourself. You're going to you know, be destroyed by the kind of aggressive grasping quality of the environment around you, that you, as a kind of Darwinian evolutionary being, are trying to kind of maintain yourself against. And there's a little bit of truth to that, for one thing, but I think there's a lot of joy in deappropriation. I mean, for one thing, I've ran a nightclub for the last year in Toronto, a dance club where we played different kind of emerging electronic dance music from around the world, and it kind of reminded me it's just how beautiful the space of the dance floor is and the kind of erotics of the dance floor where you have all these multiple bodies kind of tangled up in each other and with each other, and how liberating that actually is. And that on a dance floor you let go of your boundaries a little bit, and some kind of space that isn't owned by any particular person emerges, and people actually are quite refined and elegant for the most part in how they operate in those spaces. I mean, there's occasional sort of drunken predators or whatever, but in general we know how to be quite loving in those spaces. And I think it's a good example of a situation in which deappropriation actually happens. And I think eroticism in general depends on deappropriation. You know, that it's a kind of exposure and a letting go of boundaries that allows connectedness to happen.
Well, it's interesting because then that eroticism leads to more reproduction, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was always fascinated with that, the way that, okay, there's this thing we call sexual reproduction, which is all about the reproduction of the species, but that we have this kind of funny dance around it that is not, you know, like you could make babies in a test tube or I guess or whatever, but the profundity of that sort of erotic dance that has almost as a side effect this this reproduction of organic life, but that it opens up as well to a space of sharing and collectivity and lovingness that I think is really profound. And I think it could be extended to a lot of different areas or more areas. And when people are sharing in different ways, whether it's on the internet, whether it's at a festival or a party, or whether it's in some kind of spiritual practice where they make sacrifices, like, it points to the possibility of society that's not built around having to hold on to things. So I think it's not just a dream, it's something we're already involved with, and it's something that we can develop as we gain consciousness of the existence, you know, of that deappropriated realm.
Well, again, that's one of the wonderful things about your book, I think, is that it gives a lot more depth to the more utopian or liberatory aspects of the kind of cultures of copying that we're more familiar with in terms of the internet, in terms of intellectual property, in terms of creative commons, in terms of you know, the ways that a lot of people more generally think about copying today, because it's not just about, oh, this is fun, or oh, this is something we always do anyway, just get used to it. It's that it really connects it up with some of our deeper quests for meaning and for being. I mean, I was kind of thinking about how we're stuck in this kind of paradox where we're in the society of mass reproduction, which gives us which we know on some level is the same thing that we try to appropriate as something that makes us individual, and yet in a way we are more comfortable with just the little bit of singularity, the little bit of originality that comes along with copying and with sharing, where there's a chain of variation, where I take something, I make a mixtape, I change it a little bit, and I pass it on to somebody else. There was something original there. There was something unique on some level, but it doesn't have the same burden of uniqueness or individuality that we are sort of set with in our society, that in a lot of ways is not only an illusion but an oppressive one, and one that that surrounds a lot of anxiety and even violence to some degree. But there, it's not that when you submit to the copy, you submit to complete replication or a kind of idiocy of aping. That's unfair to our ape brothers to say that. But instead, it's like entering into a world where it's more of a play. It's more erotic. It's more where there's a touch of contact, a transformation, the one dance move that you come up with that then a minute later is reproduced as other people pick it up surrounding you. And it's not that we lose that sense of being unique or being original, but that we approach it or find it in a different way, more modest in some ways, but also more pervasive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a political dimension to it that's interesting, though, too, which is that we are all the same in a certain sense. And, you know, the ideology of individuality also supports, in a way, the way we separate ourselves from the masses of the poor around the world, who also have the same right to exist that we do, and who somehow, through the stories of individuality that we tell ourselves, we separate ourselves from. And I think the scarier dimensions, but also the more profound dimensions of sameness, but also emptiness, emerge when you start to think about globally us all having a certain sameness and this, an equality, and how we might actually let go of some of those boundaries that really make possible a global society where we all have the same right to live and we recognize it. And I think we get a taste of that, I think, on the dance floor. And we're generally right now, I think, trying to develop protocols that allow us to recognize universality.
It's funny you say that. I mean, there's a point in your book where you aggressively use the word holism, and made me think in the intellectual climates that you move in a lot as a professor and someone writing scholarly books. I'm familiar with as well. There's this horror of holes, of universals, of samenesses, and yet I was talking to my brother-in-law who's an academic. The other night, and saying, you know, difference is easy. Talking about differences and we got that down. The real challenge now is talking about the same and sneaking up on the same in a way that doesn't fall into some of the traps that had been earlier sort of identified with it.
Yeah, I think that is the challenge, is understanding sameness and what exactly. What it means to say that we're all the same, because I don't think it means that we're just kind of robot-like clones, although we also have that dimension of, you know, similarity of DNA and all the rest of it, but that there's a sameness that's not conceptual, but consists of the lack of concepts, in a way, like the fact that there's no essence there, that might be our sameness. And understanding what that means ethically and politically, that, I think, is our big challenge going forward.
Well, I wanted to let people know that they can find Marcus Boone online at marcusboone.com. And do you have anything else coming up, Marcus?
Not really. I still write for the English music magazine, The Wire, and I'm going to continue doing that. I'm still kind of obsessed with musical cultures, and I'm hoping to sort of work more on that in the near future, and maybe throw some more dance parties as well.
Well, I was going to ask you, can you please post some of your mixes online? I mean, I was just at a wedding and they were playing some cumbia, and I have to admit it was so much more fun than all the like white music and funk music that they were also playing, because I was like, man, I have not heard something this insane in a long time. So I'm sure you're up on many of these global mutations of robot dance musics.
Cumbia rules. It's such a delightful musical sound, and it's a great example of something. It's now being taken in so many different directions globally, the cumbia style. But funnily enough, I don't actually record the mixes I do, even though I'm obsessed with copying. I don't make copies of them. I really like the way it's something that you go into a particular room and there's a group of people that make the commitment of coming to that room, and then something happens, and it's all about copies, like you're using copies of recordings and all the rest of it. But it turns out a particular way in that moment, and that's it. Even though I love other people's mixtapes and all the rest of it, but I really like the kind of uniqueness of that coming together.
Well, that's a wonderful analogy to leave this discussion on. Marcus, thank you so much for joining us and expanding mine. Marcus Boone's book, In Praise of Copying, highly, highly worthwhile. I really recommend folks check it out. I'm Eric Davis with Maja Daou. Keep your minds open.